Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, we will continue now with the study of the Alagadupama Sutta. This is Sutta number 22 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And just to review what we covered last time, okay, the sutta opens when a monk by the name of Arita has been promulgating a view. The view is described in the sutta as a pernicious view. He is saying that as I understand the Dhamma taught by the Buddha, those things called obstructions by the Buddha, the Blessed One, are not able to obstruct one who engages in them. In other words, he's almost saying that what the Buddha teaches is something that's self-contradictory, that obstructions are not really obstructions. And so, as this monk Arita is propagating this view, other monks hear about it, they try to dissuade him from that view. When they don't succeed, they bring him to the Buddha. And the important thing about this view, exactly what he is holding, you know, the more specific details of his view are not spelt out in the sutta, but when the monks are trying to detach him from that view, they repeatedly say that the Buddha has explained how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering and much despair, and that there is great danger in them. And so what the commentary brings out is that the view that Arita has been actually promulgating is that there is no harm and danger if a monastic person, a person ordained as a monk or nun, were to engage in sexual activity. Okay, so the monks, when they cannot dissuade Arita from this claim that he's making, they bring him to the Buddha, who, after getting him to admit his view, then again tells him that he has again and again proclaimed that things that are declared to be obstructions are really able to obstruct one who engages in them. And then he repeats, the Buddha repeats, how he has stated in many ways that sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering, and so on. And then he refers to a series of similes that he used to illustrate the dangers and sensual pleasures. Then the Buddha brings in the simile that gives the title to the sutta, the simile of the water snake, the poisonous water snake, how some people, misguided men or foolish men, learn the Dhamma but do not examine the meaning of the Dhamma with wisdom. Instead, they learn the teaching only for the sake of arguing with others, engaging in debates. And so for them, learning the teaching is like they wrongly grasp the teaching, which leads to their harm and suffering for a long time. And this, the Buddha says, is like a man who needs a water snake. as I said last week, it's believed that certain types of poisonous water snakes have the poison in their sacs, which can be used to make medicine. And so if the man needs the snake to get the poison, if he grasps the snake wrongly by the tail or by the lower part of the body, the snake will turn around and bite his hand or his arm, and then he might die or undergo terrible suffering. And that is because of his wrong grasp of the snake. That is like these people who wrongly grasp the teaching. In contrast, there are other people, other clansmen, who learn the Dhamma rightly, examine the meaning of the teaching with wisdom, and gain the true benefit of the teaching. This is because of their right grasp of the teaching. And this is like the man who needs the water snake, grasps the water snake correctly, using a cleft stick, grasps the snake by the neck. Then the snake cannot turn around and bite the person. And then they're able to extract the poison and use it to make the medicine. And so this is like the people, the monks, who learn the teaching and use it properly and understand the meaning of the teaching with wisdom. And it all comes down to their right grasp of the teaching. Okay, that is as far as we got last time. And now we come to the next simile. Again, this is a very important and very well-known simile in the Buddha's teaching. I think there are sometimes books on Buddhism named after this simile, poems written named after this simile. This is the simile of the raft. Okay, so now the Buddha continues. We're on page 228, paragraph 13. The Buddha says, "Monks, I shall teach you how the Dhamma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping." Okay, now here's an interesting point. We have this word or this phrase here, "not for the purpose of grasping." And this is the way I would understand why the simile of the raft is placed right here. I would see the simile of the raft as a kind of continuation and a corrective to a possible misunderstanding of the simile of the water snake. Because the simile of the water snake ends with paragraph 11 with the words that these clansmen learn the Dhamma and benefit from the Dhamma. Why is that? Because of the right grasp of those teachings. The words, the phrase in Pali is sugahitata, which is from the verb ganhati, to grasp. Okay, now, if one misunderstands, or even if one understands intellectually, but one doesn't have the right attitude, then one thinks the Dhamma is something to grasp and cling to, like a possession, or just something to identify with, or again, something to use for intellectual games. But that would be a case of dukkahita, grasping the Dhamma wrongly. Even though one thinks one is rightly grasping the Dhamma. So now the Buddha is saying that if you rightly grasp the Dhamma, it means you're not grasping it, but you're using it to cross over. On the other hand, if you are using the Dhamma not to cross over, but are grasping it, then that in itself is a wrong grasp of the teaching. And so the Buddha illustrates this point with a simile of the raft. And I have to say, and this is not intended out of disrespect, sir, venerable sir, but the simile doesn't quite work, as we'll see. That is, if one wrongly grasps it, takes it too literally. Okay, suppose a man in the course of a journey sees a great expanse of water whose near shore is dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore is safe and free from fear. But there is no ferry boat or bridge for going to the far shore. Okay, so he thinks there's this great expanse of water, no way to get across, what am I going to do? So he collects together grass, twigs, and so on, and makes a raft. And then, supported by the raft, using his hands and feet, he gets safely across to the far shore. Okay, then when he gets safely across and arrives on the far shore, he thinks, this raft has been very helpful to me, supported by it, making the effort with my hands and feet. I got safely across to the far shore. And so now, out of gratitude to the raft, and this to express his appreciation to it, and thinking maybe this raft will continue to be useful to him as he's walking along on the land, he puts the raft on his head, or puts it on his shoulder, and goes walking off onto the land. Okay, and so now the Buddha says, is that man doing what he should be doing with the raft? And of course the answer is no. And so what should the man be doing with that raft? And so what the man should be doing, what should he be doing? Okay, once he gets onto the far shore, what he should do is to haul the raft onto the dry land, or let it drift in the water, and then go freely wherever he wants. And so the Buddha then says, so I have shown you how the Dhamma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. Okay, this simile of the dangerous shore, the expanse of water, the safe far shore, making the raft. This, in a way, it's referring to another sutta that comes in the Samyutta Nikaya, Salayatana Samyutta. I should have jotted the number down, someplace in 200 or something, where a man is being pursued by four snakes that represent the four elements, five murderers, a bunch of dangerous enemies. Then he comes to a body of water and he gets makes a raft to get across to the far shore. And here the Buddha explains that this near shore, this is the shore of samsara, and the far shore is nibbana. Okay, and the raft is the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, and so now, in the simile, the reason why I say it doesn't quite work if one takes it too literally is that the man who gets onto the far shore would be an arahant. And an arahant has no more clinging left, and he has perfect understanding of the purpose of the path. And so he, just by his nature, he would not cling to the path, not cling to the teaching. What usually happens is one of two things. It's people who are still on this shore that carry the raft around on their head. That is similar to the people who grasp hold of the water snake in the wrong way. That is, they learn the teaching, use it just for the purpose of debate, or they just learn it completely intellectually, memorize it, admire it as something beautiful, but maybe try to impress others with their knowledge of the teaching, but don't try to put the teaching into practice. Maybe occasionally they might take a little dip into the water carrying the raft on their head, going a little few steps into the water. Then we call this wading, is that what it's called? Wading out a few steps into the water, testing the raft a little bit, just to make sure that one of these days, maybe in some future life, they can get across with the raft. Then beating a retreat to this shore. Okay, that's one of the things that happens. Or else, what often happens, or sometimes happens, is that some people will discard the raft on this shore and claim that they don't need the raft, that they've already gotten enlightened without it. And so they don't make any further effort to go across because they're enlightened, so why make an effort with the raft? And so they think that they're across on the other shore, while they're still very much on this shore, and so they don't use the Dhamma at all to go across. While those who use the Dhamma and get across to the other shore, those very few, by their very nature, by their wisdom, by their realization, they won't put the Dhamma on their head and just carry it around. Okay, so we can't take this simile too literally and then try to pick faults with it. We should just try to understand the point of the simile. And the point of the simile is what is said in the last sentence. I have shown you how the Dhamma is similar to a raft. That is, it is for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. So one uses the teaching, the Dhamma, in order to cross over this body of water, this stream, this current of, call it the stream of ignorance, craving, wrong views. Okay, then in paragraph 14, the very short statement, but very important, very powerful statement. the Buddha says, when you know or when you understand the Dhamma to be similar to a raft, or when you understand the simile of the raft, then you should abandon even the, I have to say, any translation is very inadequate here. This is why the translation doesn't adhere too closely to the wording. I think I, or Venerable Nyanamoli, added the word Dhamma here in order to bring out something that otherwise the translation couldn't capture. I go over it again. When you know the Dhamma to be similar to a raft, you should abandon even the teachings. How much more than, or how much more so, things contrary to the teachings? Let me give it to you directly in Pali. Kulupamang vo bhikave ajanantehi Dhamma pivo pahataba pageva adhamma. Now, the word translated teachings here is Dhamma. That is, it's the word Dhamma in the plural. And then the word that is translated clumsily, things contrary to the teachings, is the word adhamma, just non-dhammas. So, when you understand the simile of the raft, then dhammas should be abandoned by you. How much more than non-dhammas? And this statement can be understood at different levels. And that's why when we translate it, we have to use some word here. We put in the word teachings, we get one level, but then we miss out on other levels. Okay, at one level, we take the word Dhamma here to refer to the teachings. And here, now, we could see it as referring back to the simile of the snake. Okay, now, these wise clansmen, and I'm sorry, the Buddha, of course, he's speaking in the period, that particular historical period, so he refers to clansmen, but we would say now young men and young women of good family. Learn the Dhamma, okay, rightly. Okay, they examine the meaning of the teachings, so they're rightly grasping the teachings. That's, we say, the first stage is to learn the teachings, to learn them rightly, to examine the meaning. To examine the meaning with wisdom. That's getting a right grasp of the teachings. But then we understand that the teachings are not for grasping. So once we get the right grasp of the teaching, that is, we understand it rightly, then we apply the teaching. We use it like the raft for going across to the far shore. Then once we get to the far shore, and here we have to be very careful, when it says that one abandons the teachings, it doesn't mean that one gives up the Buddha's teaching and one just, as an enlightened person, one just goes on a wild holiday and becomes free to indulge and enjoy oneself and do anything one wants, that one is now sort of beyond good and evil and can just barnstorm around. But it means that one now, in a sense, becomes the master of the teachings, so that one no longer has to ride, you could say, one no longer has to ride the vehicle of the teachings, but now one is the master of the teachings. One can use the teachings to guide others, but one no longer depends on the teachings for one's own enlightenment and liberation. But even the enlightened person still has right view, right thought, right action, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right, a certain type of right effort. It's no longer the right effort to get rid of the unwholesome and to develop the wholesome, but just the natural energy of that person is the right effort. That person has a natural right mindfulness. And when that person wants to enter samadhi, they will naturally go into right concentration. And they always have right liberation and right knowledge and vision of liberation. The commentary gives another interesting highlight on this expression that you should abandon dhammas even more than non-dhammas. It's maybe a little too specific to be taken as the original intention of the expression, but it gives an interesting sidelight or highlight on this statement. It says that we could understand by dhammas here serenity and insight, that is, samatha and vipassana. And it refers to some expressions or passages from the text in which the Buddha is explaining to the monks how to develop each of the jhanas. And then the Buddha says, even the first jhana you should abandon and go to the second jhana. Even that you should abandon and go to the third jhana. Even that you abandon, go to the fourth jhana. And so on, so on, so on, up to the highest jhana. And then even that you should abandon and enter the state of final liberation. So that's not that's called abandoning the dhammas as abandoning attachment to samadhi or serenity. Then abandoning attachment to vipassana. There are some statements where the Buddha says, when you gain that pure, bright wisdom of insight, even that wisdom you should not cling to, fondle, and claim to be your own. But use that wisdom only for the purpose of crossing over. Okay, maybe I'll ask if there's any questions now on the simile of the raft before I go further. Okay, then we go on to the next.
I just wanted to say maybe a word you can say when you after one will cross on the raft that one becomes Dharma, right? Or you
say becomes what?
One becomes the Dharma.
I wouldn't say literally that one becomes the Dharma, but one embodies the qualities of the Dharma within oneself. Okay, let us go on then to the next section. We'll see that now at deeper and deeper levels, the Buddha is going to be teaching this principle of non-attachment, relinquishment. Especially the non-relinquishment, the non-attachment to any views. Okay, so now he takes up what are called the six standpoints for views, six dittithana. Dittithanani, dittithanani. And he's going to explain these six standpoints for views by making a contrast between two types of persons. On the one hand, there will be what are called, politely, the untaught ordinary person. This is the asuttava puttujino. The person, okay, on one hand, the untaught ordinary person, and on the other hand is the well-taught or instructed noble disciple. Okay, the untaught ordinary person is described as one who has no regard for the noble one. For the Aryans, one who is unskilled in the teaching of the noble ones. That is, one who has no understanding or insight into the teaching of the noble ones, and who is undisciplined in the teaching of the noble ones. That is, who has no practical training in the teaching, in their teaching. And the noble ones are also called sapurisa, true men. Now I would translate true persons. Okay, such a person falls a victim to different types of views regarding the five aggregates. Usually these views are expounded in terms of a set of 20, which are called the 20 types of, sometimes translated, personality view or identity view, 20 ways of formulating the view of self. Here, the Buddha is going to explain the way in which the ordinary person relates to the five aggregates in a somewhat different way. In regard to each aggregate, he's going to take three attitudes that this ordinary person adopts to each aggregate. These attitudes are expressed by the words, "This is mine, this I am, this is myself." And these three expressions are understood to represent what are called the three obsessions. And each obsession springs from a different defilement. The obsession, "This is mine," springs from tanha, from craving. The obsession, consideration, "This I am," stems from the conceit I am. And the obsession, this is myself, is, you call this a formulation of a speculative view of self. So it represents the tendency to speculation, to speculative views of self. And of course, all three of those originate from ignorance, avijja. I have to admit, one thing gives me a little problem is the phrase, this I am, because in some places this is also taken to cover identity view. So sometimes it's placed on the side of conceit, sometimes on the side of identity view. But I think when you have the three laid out here, this I am represents conceit, and this is myself represents the view of self, identity view. Okay, and now all three of these apply to all five aggregates. And then this, we see this pattern developed very often with, in regard to the five aggregates. I think in some other suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, very often in the Saṅyutta Nikaya. In this particular passage, it's quite evident regarding the aggregate of material form. Then we come to feeling, then perception, then the volitional formations. But then, where we should come to the aggregate of consciousness, here we come to what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, encountered, sought, and mentally pondered. And I have to say, according to the commentary, this phrase here is taken to represent the aggregate of consciousness. It represents it by way of its objects. If you ask me, why doesn't the text simply say he regards consciousness thus, why use this roundabout way of saying that? Wo bu zhi dao. I don't know. The commentary also doesn't give, it glosses it. It says this is the aggregate of consciousness. It doesn't give a clear explanation why this particular sutta is phrased in this way rather than simply coming straight out and saying the aggregate of consciousness. I should have looked in the sub-commentary. Maybe the answer is there. But that gets 1,100, 1,200 years after the time of the Buddha to get the answer. Okay. Though I can't give the answer to that particular question, but we could say, the seen represents eye consciousness, the heard represents ear consciousness, the sensed can represent nose, tongue, and body consciousness. And then the other terms, what is cognized, encountered, sought, and mentally pondered, will represent the internal mental consciousness, mano-vijnana. Okay, and then as a sixth standpoint for views, we have something interesting. Okay. That which is the self is the world. Let me get the original. So loco, so atta. That world, that self. That's literally what the text says. But it's a way of establishing an identity. That which is the world is the self. After death, I shall be permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change. I shall endure as long as eternity. This too he regards thus. This is mine. This I am. This is myself. Okay, this is the way I would understand this. That, well, first of all, this view seems to be something more sophisticated than simply just the ordinary identification that we might have with one or another of the five aggregates. But this seems to be a more philosophically developed, you call it a more sophisticated, blown up, speculative view. A full-fledged eternalist view, which seems to be a somewhat, let us say, somewhat reminiscent of the types of views that we find being discussed in the Vedic texts called the Upanishads. Though the way it's formulated here, it doesn't seem exactly like the views in the Upanishads, but it reminds us of them. Okay, and what is important is that this view of a permanent, eternal, everlasting self becomes an object of clinging. I find it a little difficult to see that somebody would identify with the view and say, I am the view, this is myself. Does that seem normal? But one does cling to the view with the thought, this is my view. And one likes the view and holds to the view, and one invests sometimes a lot of emotional energy into these views. Though one does that also with Buddhist views, thinking sometimes of the debates between Savastivadins, Sautrantikas, or Lakhandakattavattu, arguing the Theravada standpoint against Savastivada standpoint, Mahasangika standpoint against this standpoint, not to speak of Madhyamakas arguing with Yogacharans. Anyway, people become attached to views, whether it's a view of self or different varieties of the view of non-self. Okay, then we have the contrast to that, and that is the attitude, the way taken by the well-taught noble disciple. This is the one who has regard for noble ones and is skilled and disciplined in their teaching. who has regard for the true men, or I would say the true persons, and is skilled and disciplined in their teaching. And I used to think, and I think some interpreters used to think, that a well-taught noble disciple is necessarily one who has reached one of at least the stage of stream entera. Now I don't think that is the case. I think the well-taught noble disciple simply means a disciple who has correct understanding of the Dhamma and is practicing rightly in the Dhamma. But I don't think it necessarily means one who has achieved the first stage of realization. Okay, such a person regards each of the five aggregates as not mine, not I, not myself. In that way, this disciple can release himself, herself, from attachment to the five aggregates. That is, in a sense, you could call this, I like to think of this statement, not mine, not I, not myself, the sword that cuts away all of the ropes of attachment that bind us to the five aggregates. And so by using this contemplation, not mine, not I, not myself, one can cut away the attachment of craving, conceit, and wrong views, speculative views, concerning the five aggregates. Okay, and so one eliminates these three obsessions regarding the five aggregates. And then coming to paragraph 17, the Buddha says, since he regards them thus, he, the disciple, is not agitated about what is not non-existent. And it seems that when the Buddha makes the statement about what is non-existent, what he's implying is the non-existence of any self in relation to the five aggregates. And here we come to that important word. I mentioned this word in relation to the previous sutta that we studied, the Chula Siha Nada Sutta, the shorter discourse on the lion's roar. But now I'll explain it again. The verb here, it's translated, he is not agitated. That will become the heading for the next section. Now I lost my place. Okay. Naparitasati. I won't repeat the detailed explanation, but this verb paritasati from this we get the noun paritasana. Originally, this would be related etymologically, that is by way of word derivation, to the word tanha, which means craving. One could see this from the Sanskrit. It doesn't say it so clearly in the Pali. In fact, there's a Pali, an alternative Pali way of representing the word Trishna. Instead of Tanha, another way that appears in some places in the Samyutta Nikaya is Tasina. I'm not sure. I don't remember whether it has a long A or a short A at the end. So instead of turning Trishna into Tanha, in some places they turn it into Tasina. Then one could see the connection with Paritasana here. So Paritasana originally had the sense of craving. But by the time this word came down to the Buddha's period, it got conflated, that is, mixed with another verb, tasati, meaning to be afraid. And so the word paritasana took on two meanings. The commentary explains, or the commentary uses these phrases. Baya paritasana and tanha paritasana. And so a translator meeting the word paritasana has to find a word that can capture the nuances of both craving and fear. So shamatso. What does one do? How does one do? What is that? I think anxiety leans too much towards fear. I think Venerable Nyanamoli I'm not sure whether he originally had anxiety or anguish. But I thought it was not satisfactory what he had originally, because it swung too much towards the side of fear. So then I thought agitation somehow was capable of falling on either side of that divide. And so then I went for agitation. Okay, I think we will end at this point, and then next time we'll come into this section on agitation, anxiety or anguish, whatever. Okay, if there's any questions, comments, points to discuss, please feel welcome to. Yeah, George.
In the previous part where they talked about this self, the world is myself.
Yeah.
Is that like the Ajna?
In fact, the word for self there, always the word for self in Pali is atta, which is just the Pali equivalent of Sanskrit atman or atma. But here, if the point of your question is this the Upanishadic atman? As I said, it seems to be some version of it is reminiscent of the types of views of the self that we find in the Upanishad. The view that in the Upanishad, the view is developed that there is some supreme reality which underlies all manifest phenomena. That supreme reality is called Brahman, the divine spirit, the supreme reality, the holy reality, and that is the reality underlying the entire universe, all external, all natural phenomena, all the stars, planets, everything, what sustains the whole world and becomes manifest as the whole world is Brahman. And then looking within oneself, what is the ultimate, this is what the sages of the Upanishads were investigating, what is the ultimate truth of oneself, they would, somewhat similar to the way the Buddha approached this, examine, is the self, can it be the body? No. Can it be the feelings? No. So they would negate all the phenomenal aspects of the personality. Can it be thoughts? No. States of mind, emotions, the vital energies? No. Till they arrive at the conception of some innermost self which they identify with the source of awareness. And that is what they call Atman. So we get a innermost self, the Atman, and then an ultimate reality underlying the external world, the natural world, Brahman. And then the problem that the Upanishadic thinkers faced, how do we relate them? And then what seemed to be the great discovery of the Upanishads, sort of the innermost secret, it's just what is said here, is that which is the innermost self is also identical with that ultimate reality that underlies all of the natural world. And that supreme holy reality that underlies the whole natural world is none other than one's own innermost self. So the way it's presented here, it's not the why, reason why I say it's not exactly the same. It's said simply, after death, that is what I shall be after death. Permanent, everlasting, eternal. According to the thinkers of the Upanishads, one doesn't automatically become that after death. But after death, one goes on being reborn. This is the individual self goes on reincarnating until one realizes the truth of the identity of Atman with Brahman. And only then does one cast off the phenomenal, the finite personality, and one remains what one has always been, this identity of the self with the Brahman. Yeah.
So you're saying they're the same? The concept here in the Upanishad?
I'm not saying that they're the same. There seems to be a certain difference. What I said is that the view expressed here is, I use the word reminiscent. It seems to have a certain, maybe use the expression, family resemblance. But as it's stated here, it has a certain difference in that in the Upanishads, this view of the identity of self with Atman, it's something to be realized, and that one doesn't automatically become that after death. And also when one realizes that identity of the self with Atman, it's not something that one becomes after death, but one realizes that this is something which has always been existing. But what happens, at least this is in one passage in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, it's when one realizes this identity of the self and the Brahman, that one brings to an end the process of reincarnation, of transmigration, and then the phenomenal personality is cast off, and this true reality, the self, which is also Brahman, just simply remains forever what it has always been.
But aren't you saying here there isn't the self, there really isn't Brahman?
That is the Buddhist standpoint. But I'm just explaining what is said in the Upanishads.
Right, okay.
Yeah. The Buddhist standpoint with the...
Yeah.
No, I'm explaining the... From with the Upanishadic standpoint, and I'm relating it to, not to the Buddhist standpoint, but to this particular standpoint for views that's stated here about the self at being the world and as being something that is permanent and everlasting after death. Yes, yeah, Suki?
Maybe your question is instead of so loco, so atta.
Yeah.
Maybe so panchakanda, so atta.
You mean using is this view using the world as in other words, is this statement using the world as to represent the five aggregates as a collective whole rather than individual aggregates? Is that the point?
I think she's saying the self is the five aggregates that people may think is the self. Is it the same self as the self of the Upanishads? Is that what you're saying?
I think we just have to accept that this is the way the Buddhist texts have picked up a view that was in circulation in that period and the way they represent that view, and not try to filter this view through Buddhist categories like the five aggregates. Okay, I think we'll stop for the evening and end with the dedication of the merits. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu mangparang. Etavata chamhehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang Sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya.